And we are live. Welcome to episode 233. Man, it's a lot of episodes, Anshul. The G2 on 5G. It's the latest insight scoop on everything 5G and 6G. We cover six topics in about 20 minutes, and it's brought to you by More Insights and Strategy. I'm Will Townsend, and joining me again this week is fellow analyst Anshul Sag. Let's get started with my first topic. I'm talking about a lot of infrastructure because that's my coverage area. I want to talk about Telefonica, and no surprise, they are phasing out Huawei in Spain and Germany, but not Brazil. This is very interesting. Most mobile network operators are going wholesale across the board with the rip and replace of Chinese infrastructure. Obviously, in the EU and in Spain and Germany, that is a requirement. Telefonica is heeding that requirement. But Brazil doesn't have those same stipulations, and so they're keeping Huawei infrastructure in place. So I find this really interesting from my perspective. And I haven't spoken with Telefonica management, but they're obviously not concerned about Huawei using its infrastructure in Brazil for spy activity and nefarious other sorts of things there. So I find it really interesting that they're one of the few European operators that are cherry picking what they do regionally. And obviously there's significant expense in ripping and replacing this infrastructure. And one of the ways that ZTE and Huawei did get their foothold in places like Europe and places like the African continent was that they came in with just incredibly low-cost core infrastructure and RAN infrastructure and transport infrastructure to do that. So what do you think about this whole cherry-pick scenario with Telefonica?
The way I describe it is peachy. I think that when you look at what they do, it's very much about cost and regulatory environment, and the regulators don't have a policy in place. Why rip and replace?
Why subject yourself to the cost? But apparently they're not concerned in Brazil about any sort of concerns around spying and sweeping and that sort of thing.
I think every carrier, whether they're a multinational or a single national, they have different strategies based on the countries that they operate in.
Yeah, based on ARPU, right? Some country, it's going to be the average revenue per user is going to be lower, right?
Yeah, and not just that, but also the regulatory environment's different.
Yeah.
AT&T operates differently in the U.S. than they do in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sure Vodafone operates differently in every single region that they're in. So I think that's part of it, is like Telefonica is actually quite large, and they are following the lead of what the regulators have pushed them.
No, that's a good point. It's a cost balance. It's a regulatory balance. Yeah. And it's interesting because we've been talking about this for many years. It's one of those situations where, you know, when the U.S. government first brought this up and the concern, it was, we have grave concerns, but we can't share those concerns. It's one of those situations where they could tell us, they'd have to kill us. One of those, you first buy type scenarios. So we may never know the extent. Bottom line, I'm not going to defend Huawei, but the infrastructure providers don't manage the daily operation of infrastructure. It's mobile network operators that do that. And there are tons of tools, observability tools, monitoring tools that allow them to monitor anomalous activity. And there's also a huge scrutiny on cybersecurity controls as well within mobile networks, because they're just so massive and there's so many devices and they are difficult to secure. You and I recently, we spent time with Zscaler on our standalone episode and we were talking about what they're doing with a secure SIM. But yeah, it's all super interesting. You want to go to your first topic, and I did catch some news on this and I also caught some news from the FCC. But once again, EchoStar and Dish are avoiding default.
Yeah, so I'm going to use the term that our friends at FierceNet did, which is EchoStar Dish Boost Mobile. And yes, they made a payment that was originally due on July 1st, which avoids default because it's within 30 days. Yeah. This was yesterday.
Went down to the wire. It's 30
again. Again, truly, if I were someone giving debt or financing debt, I would not be dealing with them. But their stock did pop 8% yesterday as a result of an 8K filing that said that Dish was the entity that made the scheduled interest payment that was originally due on July 1st. And they also said that they're still negotiating with the FCC related to the Chairman Carr's concern. And I see this as a negotiating tactic and as a stalling tactic. And it's quite clear that they are negotiating because Kars mentioned his discussions with Dish and Charlie Ergen.
Yeah.
But also, it might be that the Trump administration sees Dish as an opportunity to free up more spectrum or auctions. It's really unclear what will happen here, because a lot of people are saying that the 8K filing is pretty vague. But I think we're really in a place, I think the company as a whole is in limbo. We've even talked how they might even be considering merging their mobile business with MobileX and MVNO. So we'll see what actually ends up happening. But I think there's a reality where they get some kind of capital infusion to stave off the FCC. But truthfully, it feels like the FCC wants to take spectrum from them regardless of what they do. I think they might give away some spectrum that they're not using because they do have a lot of it. Maybe that 850 that they had already, but they obviously didn't buy the 850 that they were supposed to get from T-Mobile.
Yeah.
So I don't really know. It's not like they hoarded that spectrum. They just let it go. So I'm in a weird place because I don't really like the FCC bull anyone, but it really does feel like the FCC is bullying them at this point. But again, they have a track record of being a spectrum squatter. So I don't think either party is really in the right here. And I'm not really sure if Dish is no longer a competitive carrier, that will be good for consumers.
Yeah, I'm divided on this too. Yeah, they have been sitting on spectrum for quite some time. I don't think the tactics, because I did read a statement from Carr, where they're trying to put pressure on Dish, and Carr is stating it's like, hey, we need to claw back the spectrum, and hey, it's super valuable. This could be a reaction to your point in additional, potentially billions of dollars could be put back into U.S. government's bank account here. The whole notion of Dish and what T-Mobile had to do to divest itself and provide them sort of a level playing field was a good thing. You know, it was going to be a good thing to have a fourth competitive MNO, but Dish is clearly not executed at all. And there's clearly a financial issue here. And I don't, you and I have been talking about this for how many years, Ron? Like almost as long as the whole Apple modem thing. And that finally happened after Rich, right?
Yeah.
It'll be a shit that happens. But right, let me go to my second topic. I want to talk about Nokia. And they've scored multiple subsea cable deals recently. There are two. The most recent one is to power a connection between Jakarta and Singapore. And this is supporting Surge. And Surge is an Indonesian digital infrastructure provider. And a few days ago, Nokia announced that they would be used in the Medusa submarine cable system, which is going to connect North Africa and Europe. And that's expected to be fully operational by the early part of next year. I'm not surprised to see this from Nokia. And I think I've mentioned this on prior podcasts. They have considerable strength in optical. And you can also include Huawei. We were just talking about Huawei. They've got strength in optical as well as Cisco. But I think this is a great deal for Nokia, because we've been talking about how both Nokia and Ericsson need to find new ways to expand the revenue base. The RAN piece for 5G has wound itself out. And now the standalone network are getting with core infrastructure deployments. So I think this is super strong. I caught this recent article about the Jakarta-Singapore undersea cable in Light Reading. I don't really see numbers here and what this deal is going to be worth to Nokia, but it's significant because there's another kind of thing percolating. And we were just talking about the rip and replace of cellular infrastructure with Telefonica, with Huawei in Spain and Germany. But there are also concerns about Chinese infrastructure that's tied to subsea cables. And that could trigger a rip and replace. That would be pretty considerably expensive when you think about the length of these undersea cables and what's involved in laying them and that sort of thing. Time will tell if you will see, you know, the rip and replace of Chinese infrastructure there. But in high level, I think this is a great news for Nokia. It'll be interesting to see how this rings the cash register for them. But what are your thoughts before we go to your second topic?
Do you know how big this business is for Nokia already?
So optical is a huge business for Nokia. And so this is obviously a part of their optical business. And again, it plays to one of their strengths in optical. So it's significant. So it's significant. It's potentially significant from a revenue standpoint, although I don't see the numbers there. But again, it does play to their strength and their capabilities. And so it's very strategic, to coin your term that you just used a second ago.
I do think optical cables, specifically deep sea cables, are super important, because I think if we were to have another global war of any sort, that might be one of the first things that countries start to snip.
It's been happening. Yeah.
But those are like warning shots.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to have these kinds of things with backups in place, is what I'm saying. So I think more deep sea cables are, I think Key West could probably use a good deep sea cable. So there's going to be more demand for this kind of work, and look, Nokia is at the forefront of it.
Yeah, for sure. And this is supporting the whole notion of connecting AI data centers as well. And I agree with you. I think we're going to see more, and I think we could see some activity. A lot of this is in the Atlantic. And obviously, when we're talking about Indonesia, we're talking about Southeast Asia. But I think there are opportunities for undersea cables in the Pacific as well. But what I like about this particular deployment is that it's going to help bridge connectivity for Indonesia, which has challenges, just like we do in rural parts of America and rural parts of Europe and the rest of the world. But hey, let's go to your second topic. And you want to talk about Wi-Fi 8. So the spec details have been released. And so what's Wi-Fi 8 all about? Just fast?
So actually, there's a lot of discourse about this. It's known as 802.11bn, which is the IEEE designation. Kind of like, we know, 802.11ac,
right.
EGN, all letters AY, AD, etc., right? So these are all the IEEE standards. And this is going to be next generation. There's more of a focus on quality over peak throughput. This is like what we, with Wave 2 AC, if you remember that, which is Wi-Fi 6. Wi-Fi 6 had two waves, and then we got 6E. So this is what they're calling this, ultra high reliability. This is about using Wi-Fi for more applications than consumer, and building Wi-Fi to be more robust for robotics, AGVs, drones, and automobiles,
yeah,
so that there's more anticipation that this is going to be used for enterprise use cases. This will actually have a great, I think, opportunity for growth in enterprise.
Mm-hmm. One,
they're saying that it will have at least 25% higher throughput in challenging signal conditions, which is pretty much everywhere. It will have 25% lower latency at the 95th percentile of latency distribution. So lower latency. And 25% fewer dropped packets, especially when roaming between access points, which is, again, an enterprise use case. If you think about anybody who has a mesh in their home, that's going to help them too. But also people who have enterprise deployments, these will all translate to better real-world performance numbers. So I think the focus is on reliability and taking advantage of the existing radio in a better way. And there's also talk about using it for AR glasses, health monitors, other wearables, you know, low latency peer-to-peer links. So then you also think about AI and like, how does AI want to use Wi-Fi? You also want it to be more reliable and have better real-world performance. The time frame for this is, we got draft 1.0, which is what we got. Then the Wi-Fi Alliance will start certification in January 2020.
Oh, it's pretty far up. Yeah.
Yes, there's still quite a jump to be had for Wi-Fi 8, but we're going to be with Wi-Fi 7 for quite some time. If you remember the Wi-Fi 7 journey, you know, wasn't really perfect. We already had hardware in place a year before the certification.
Yeah, there's a lot of pre-cert. Yeah.
So most likely we're going to start getting hardware in 2027.
Yeah.
Wait, early 27, maybe even late 2026.
Yeah.
And we'll start getting hardware in place, and then the certifications will come after. I believe that's how it happened with Wi-Fi 7. But Wi-Fi 7 is a great standard. I also think a lot of people haven't made the transition to it yet. I think long-term Wi-Fi 7 will be really good for a lot of reasons. But what's interesting is we're not really seeing talk of the unification of millimeter wave Wi-Fi and sub-6 Wi-Fi, which is what we've had for a long time. No talk about introduction of new bands either, but those might come down the road. But Yeah, I was really surprised Wi-Fi 8 to incorporate both millimeter waves and sub-6 Wi-Fi, and we're not seeing that here. Anyways, lots of interesting stuff to talk about. Helium actually has a really long blog that kind of details all the things that are coming in with Wi-Fi 8, and I think it's actually a pretty good read. It's not too technical, but it's technical enough that you can understand what's going to be the benefit there. They're very clearly showing it as a enterprise and industrial, connected home, public space and venue benefit. And truthfully, let's be honest, Wi-Fi has a lot of room for improvement when it comes to high density and roaming experiences.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So I had a couple of questions for you because you're always on the bleeding edge of all these standards, whether it's cellular or Wi-Fi. So is there any sort of mention around improving the number of devices and security? Because I agree with you, what it seems to be is very oriented towards a lot of enterprise use case. One of the challenges, even Wi-Fi 7, is that the encryption is pretty basic. So is there any mention of improving not only the overall number of devices per channel, but also the security, the encryption tied to it?
I did not see anything related to security.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, but I think that might also be how different Wi-Fi vendors differentiate. But you can actually go to the IEEE Standards Association's website and read the entire document, 802.11 Wi-Fi and what they're doing with BN. It's like a 4-year journey for them.
Yeah.
And they started this journey in 2022 and in parallel with Wi-Fi 7 worked on Wi-Fi 8. There was already a lot of talk about Wi-Fi 8 before Wi-Fi 7 even came out. But that's also anticipating the needs of enterprises. And I think a lot of people weren't really too impressed with Wi-Fi 6E. So I think maybe we did get some security enhancements with Wi-Fi 7, but your point, like maybe not enough. And yeah, I didn't really see anything about security, but I do think that's probably where we'll see the vendors differentiate.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and Wi-Fi 6E was a tweener, especially in enterprise environments. You've got to validate these solutions, right? And so I think there were a lot of folks that went through that process with the generation before, skipped 6E and went straight to 7. So it'll be interesting. This is going to be a long, looks like a long runway for 8, but I like it. You heard it first, reviewers and listeners. Anshul is always on top of the standards when they break. But hey, buddy, let me hit my third and final topic, and I want to talk about AT&T and Ericsson. And they've reached an Open RAN milestone. I was unaware that they were working on that. So it's called RAPP, little R, big APP. And so AT&T is claiming to be the first communication service provider globally to deploy third-party RAPP to optimize its light production network. And so what an RAPP is basically is it's an open standard Open RAN application. And the reason why AT&T and Ericsson are pointing to this and excited about this is that it marks a significant advancement in the potential for multi-vendor programmability. We've talked about AT&T and Ericsson many times on our podcast, how AT&T is embracing a fully programmable autonomous network. I spent time recently with Igali Bez, that is the AT&T network CTO. It was actually in support of EM Forum and what they are doing on a number of different projects, but driving the whole notion of autonomous networks.
Yeah.
They're claiming the first, you know, in this. And when you look at Open RAN, it's been a start and stop effort. And the whole notion and the whole idea around Open RAN was, number one, domesticate the supply chain, right? Wean ourselves off of Chinese infrastructure, but also, ironically, Ericsson and Nokia, at least in the United States. But in the whole idea was that to have this multi-vendor opportunity, but the reality today has been single vendor Open RAN. And this is interesting. So I'm wondering if this demonstration may lead other MNOs to work with, whether it's Ericsson or Nokia or Samsung or even Huawei in those parts of the world where Huawei still has a footprint, and see if something like this really gets us to a true sort of multi-vendor Open RAN. Because from my perspective, it's been single vendor. And hey, and AT&T and Ericsson are single vendor. But what's interesting, you know, as I've spoken with Yigal, and he and I met in person at the AT&T Analyst Day last December. And he and I met at a Mobile World Congress, and I'll probably see him at some point in the not too distant future. But to really, from my perspective, to realize the true promise with open rights, it's got to be multi-vendor. And I know you've got an opinion on this as well. So what's your opinion?
I think we are in a place where we should have multi-vendor because it's open RAN. But it seems like the MNOs haven't really taken a risk on vendors that they don't really have trust in. I think that's the challenge. And obviously, there's also a huge software environment as well. So they obviously want some kind of open RAN deployment that's still going to be compatible with their existing infrastructure, which I think causes them to gravitate to the same vendors.
Yeah.
Which is funny because we're not really seeing this diversity of vendors in this open RAN that we were supposed to get. Maybe that changes with 6G and with what NVIDIA is doing. But truthfully, it feels like we're just working with the same companies, even though we're supposedly in this open RAN.
Yeah.
It's just this diversity.
I think we may eventually get there to multi-vendor, but obviously there's significant development resources that have to be put in place to work with an infrastructure provider. So with respect to AT&T, and we talked about that, Nokia was supplying infrastructure to AT&T, but AT&T, a lot of people thought they doubled down on just exclusively Ericsson for the CapEx piece of it. But there's development that has to go with it. You know, and if you talk to AT&T executives, they are very transparent and open in saying that, hey, we're driving towards an ecosystem. There may be other infrastructure players that come in the pool down the road, but we needed to focus with one partner. And so that decision was made, right, wrong, or indifferent. But the final thing I'll say before we move to your final topic is that what I really like about open RAN is just the whole notion of software defined. And it's not just standing up hardware. You know, there's always a software component to deploy an infrastructure, but truly what it, like AT&T and Ericsson are doing is truly software defined, and it's going to make that network programmable. And there's also a focus on just the whole notion of exposing API to bring, you know, additional vendors and to drive innovation on top of the network, because traditionally that's where the MNOs have not done a great job. They've done a great job spending billions of dollars on spectrum, billions of dollars on core and RAN, and then it's just access. And then the over-the-top players come in and they ride on that investment and they monetize what they're doing. So I do think there is a lot of promise with the whole notion of open RAN and how software-defined it is and how there's a focus on API, closing APIs. And this is something that Ericsson's been talking about for quite some time, as well as Nokia with their autonomous networks and Samsung to a lesser extent. But with that, Samsung is a great segue to your third and final topic. And you want to talk about the Fold 7 and Flip 7. And apparently they're selling like hotcakes.
Yes, I have my Fold 7 right here. You can tell it's actually a foldable case on it, but it's the thinnest foldable I have ever used. And truthfully, I will have my review pretty soon, but I've already published my thoughts on the initial announcement. It's really just an incredible, fantastic phone. And so is the Flip 7. But what Samsung reported is pre-orders, which they have pretty generous pre-orders. Pre-orders don't really change that much from generation to generation. They're all pretty much free memory upgrades and decent trade-ins. I would say the trade-ins this year are not as generous as they have been in the past.
Yeah.
And even so, they said that they saw a 25% increase in total pre-orders across both devices.
Yeah.
And they said that their carrier partners saw a nearly 60% increase in pre-orders for the Z Fold 7, the one that I was just holding. And truthfully, it is a generational upgrade from the Fold 6 to the Fold 7. Mm-hmm. Any Fold that predates it, it's just so much thinner. The camera's so much better. Battery life is quite good. It's not as good as it could be. It's still pretty good. They also said that the Fold 7 is outpacing its previous model by nearly 50%.
Wow.
Availability opened on July 20th. So it's not even been a week, and they're already just blowing past all of their sales numbers.
Cool.
And that's what they were seeing in Korea as well, that the Fold 7 was, in some cases, outselling the Flip. That's how big of a jump the Fold is. I haven't had a foldable for maybe 6 months now, and I miss it. And I love it. And I love having dual screen, and you can have up to three apps running side by side. I usually use two, but like my number one use is just email and calendar.
Yeah.
Side by side. It's so simple, but there's so many other. If you have a restaurant and menu open while you're ordering,
right? Or
look for a restaurant, but also look at their menus at the same time. And then also, my wife and daughter both like this a lot. When I take pictures, they can see a preview of themselves on the screen before it. They pose themselves properly while I'm photographing. And then there's the whole thing where you can like set it down on a table and take a video and record things without having to need a tripod. Those are not new features. What is new is this thing is absurdly thin. It's as thin as my regular smartphones. Essentially, it's folded and then unfolded. It's even thinner. You know, I've had people react. I was at a soccer game taking pictures with my foldable open, and the guy behind me was losing his mind.
Right.
I don't want my iPhone anymore. I want one of those. I was like, it's $2,000. Like,
it's not cheap.
Like, you can trade your phone in, and if you're on a 3-year plan, it's probably not that. But yeah, in general, things are going really well for Samsung with these new foldables. And that's just in time for Apple to potentially release their new foldable next year.
I read that. What's your take on that? Would I see it during the regular sort of Apple kind of
case? Yeah. So I think we'll see it next fall. And it'll probably be very similar to the Fold 7 in terms of thickness and form factor. Because the truth is, you know, both Apple and Samsung released their super thin. Well, Apple hasn't released their super thin iPhone yet. They will. Both of these super thin phones are just a technical engineering exercise in making super thin phones that you can then make a super thin foldable. And the truth is, like, some people have gone out and measured, and there's a lot of claims about the thinnest phone this, and some people have gone out and actually measured the thickness, and the Samsung is the thinnest, and it's thickest. It's like, ignoring the camera bump, which is a super thick part of the phone, at its thinnest, like 8.8 millimeters combined when it's folded. And so that's basically the same thickness as like a regular phone. And yeah, I still have the S25 Ultra. I love that camera. The camera on the Fold is not as good as the S25 Ultra. Like, my biggest complaint is that the camera still has room for improvement. But I will say, with the exception of zoom, most of the camera capabilities on the phone are quite good. I feel like I'm choked off not having
it. Yeah, people love thin, right? And it would make sense. I just speculated about Apple to us. They would do like an iPhone Air or whatever they're going to call it first, and then follow that up with a foldable. And I think you were posting some insights. I think it was last week when I was traveling. I think I replied to one of your posts. And I said, Apple, take my money, because I've been waiting for an Apple foldable. And like, I had an Android for a while, and I've got lots of Samsung hardware, and I tested and all that, but I'm an Apple ecosystem guy. I'll be waiting, you know, with my wallet in hand when that drops, and probably get my order in. But hey, buddy, it's been another great podcast this week. Why don't we take it home?
Absolutely. We hope our viewers and listeners found this week's interesting. If anyone out there would like to provide insights on a specific 5G or 6G topic for a future podcast, please reach out to us on social media. Will is at Will.com. And I'm on Anshul Sag. I was trying to point to you and I failed. And we hope you have a great weekend. And please tune in again next week. And don't forget to rate us and subscribe.